The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, continued on cassette number 2, side 1. His overconfidence blinded him, Alsop and Catledge were to conclude. During the 20th century, 3 of the presidential landslides in America have been followed by a presidential maneuver that might be laid at least in part to overconfidence. Roosevelt's landslide in 1936 by the attempt to pack the court, Lyndon Johnson's in 1964 by escalation of the Vietnam War, Richard Nixon's of 1972 by the Watergate cover-up. There were huge Democratic majorities in both houses. The men who managed the majorities had an all but unblemished record of perfect subservience to the White House. They also had the inconvenient habit of offering advice when their advice was asked. Therefore, neither Garner nor Robinson nor anyone else was to be admitted to the secret. The carelessness of congressional feelings was carried so far that the president determined to attach a copy of the bill to the message, as though to suggest that congressional erasure of the merest comma would not be allowed. The president's lack of courtesy was far from the only reason for Garner's instant distress over the bill. The tough little Texan was not a man given to abstract thought, but there were a few concrete elements of government in which he deeply believed. The Constitution was one of them, and in the instant he first heard the president's proposal, he had no doubt that the Constitution was threatened by it. After the meeting, Garner was to recall, "I loaded my automobile with senators and representatives and took them back to the Capitol. We were all so stunned we hardly spoke." According to most accounts, the first reaction came during that ride from Texan Hatton Sumners, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. "Boys," he said, "here's where I cash in my chips." But it may actually have come earlier, from Garner. As he was leaving the meeting, he was to say, he had a quiet word with Attorney General Homer Cummings, who had secretly drafted the court-packing measure. "General," Garner said, "it will be many, many moons before the boss signs that bill." Capitol Hill was soon left in no doubt about Garner's feelings. A few hours later, while the presidential message was being read in the Senate chamber, Garner left the rostrum, stalked into the senator's private lobby behind the chamber, and there let a group of senators know his reaction by holding his nose with one hand and making a thumbs-down gesture with the other. Most congressional leaders agreed with that feeling, but party loyalty led Garner to refuse to oppose the bill publicly and to attempt to arrange a compromise. When, however, he led a group of his colleagues to put their case before the president, Roosevelt laughed in their faces so loudly that a number of them were exceedingly annoyed. So confident was Roosevelt that he was, Alsop and Catledge wrote, in a laughing mood in those days when suggestions of compromise were made. But by May, with renewed tension over sit-down strikes and general labor unrest, the vice president was, in Tommy Corcoran's words, off the reservation, almost in open revolt. Soon it was common gossip in the cloakrooms that he had told Senator Wheeler, the leader of the opposition to the court measure, "Bert, you're a real patriot." When Senator Vandenberg emotionally denounced sit-down strikes as no better than revolution, Garner left the rostrum, went down to the Senate floor, and embraced the Republican in full view of the galleries. "He was doing a lot of damage," Corcoran reported. And then Garner took his most dramatic and effective step. On June 11th, in the midst of the congressional session, he left Washington and went home to Uvalde. Although Garner gave no explanation for his departure, the reason was so evident that it exposed to public view the split, the terrible breach, Alsop and Catledge were to call it, between the New Dealers at one end of Pennsylvania Avenue and the conservatives at the other. It solidified the opposition of wavering and doubtful senators. By now, moreover, Roosevelt had begun to understand that compromise would be necessary, and that he needed Garner to obtain the best compromise possible. On June 18th, Jim Farley, Garner's old friend, found the president smoldering over the absence of the presiding officer of the Senate. "Why in hell did Jack have to leave at this time for?" he fumed through a cloud of cigarette smoke. "I'm going to write and tell him about all these stories and suggest he come back. He's got to come back." Roosevelt's letter was packed with Roosevelt charm, but for Jack Garner, the charm had long since worn thin. He did not return to Washington until July 19th, and he did so aboard the funeral train of his friend, Majority Leader Robinson, who had died suddenly of a heart attack. Garner had boarded the train in Little Rock, where the 30-odd senators on board greeted him like a long-lost father, wrote Alsop and Catledge. The old Texas Fox had made a quick trip from Uvalde, with a purpose spurring him on. He had seen the Democratic Party disintegrate in the court fight, and now he had returned to pick up the pieces. During the train ride back after Robinson's funeral, he conferred with the senators, and the next morning he arrived at the White House. When, after a great show of cordiality by Roosevelt, the subject turned to the court fight, Garner asked him, "You want it with the bark on or off, Cap'n?" Roosevelt threw back his head and, with a hearty laugh, said he would have it with the bark off. "All right," Garner said, "you're beat. You haven't got the votes." Roosevelt empowered Garner to work out a compromise. When it evolved, an agreement to recommit the court reorganization bill to the Senate Judiciary Committee, with the understanding that when it reappeared on the Senate floor, all mention of the Supreme Court would have been removed. It was an almost unmitigated defeat for the president, one which allowed him to save face only in that there would be some reorganization of lower courts. Alsop and Catledge, who did the most thorough job of contemporary interviewing of participants, concluded that Garner wanted to do the best he could for the president, and in fact did so, faced as he was with the overwhelming senatorial sentiment against the bill, and the desire of some senators to defeat it outright as a salutary lesson to the president. On one occasion, when he was attempting to bargain with Wheeler, the Montanan told him, with considerable firmness, that the opposition did not have to compromise at all, since it had enough votes to do as it pleased. But Roosevelt, sore and vengeful, in Intimate's words, took the loss hard. Wrote Alsop and Catledge, "He knew there was no way out of an immediate humiliation, but he had made up his mind that if he had to suffer the men in Congress whom he held responsible, he would suffer doubly later on. And he felt that he knew who was most responsible." To Farley, a fuming president said, "He didn't even attempt to bargain with Wheeler. He just accepted Wheeler's terms. If Garner had put up any kind of a fight, the thing could have been worked out differently." Corcoran, one of the president's principal strategists in the fight, said flatly that it was the vice president who had betrayed the president. And the emotion was not one-sided. Garner felt Roosevelt was again deviating from understandings. In the fight to replace Robinson as leader, the two men agreed, in Garner's recollection, not to interfere. In Garner's view, he kept his word, while Roosevelt did not, maneuvering to secure the election of Kentucky's Alvin Barkley. Garner had also, in a memorandum, asked the president a question. When was the government going to balance the budget? Garner had asked the question before and had been given a flat promise in reply. "I have said 50 times that the budget will be balanced for the fiscal year 1938. If you want me to say it again, I will say it either once or 50 times more. That is my intention." But the budget for fiscal 1938 proved to be heavily unbalanced. The antagonism between the two men could no longer be hidden. At cabinet meetings, Ickes noted in August 1937, "The president doesn't overlook any chance to send a pointed barb, albeit with a laugh, in the direction of the vice president." And if Roosevelt expected Garner to be faced down, he did not know his man. In December of that year, Roosevelt was discussing his upcoming message to Congress when, staring straight at Garner down the length of the long cabinet table, he said, "Jack, I'm going to reassert leadership." He said he had temporarily put it on the shelf because he was tired. Replied Garner, "You were afraid, Mr. President." Roosevelt repeated that he had been tired. "Both scared and tired," Garner retorted. Wrote Ickes, "I've never heard anyone talk like this to the president, and the president did not pursue the subject any further." Now, in 1938, with the economy sliding into a new depression, Roosevelt was considering new government pump-priming expenditures, which which would further unbalance the budget being prepared for fiscal 1939. In April 1938, Garner warned the President that such expenditures would meet with considerable congressional opposition, making these statements with vehemence. He left Roosevelt's office, the New York Times noted, red-faced and noncommittal. In an unusual outburst to a reporter, he said, "We've been trying this New Deal spending orgy for 6 years, and where has it got us? I, for one, refuse to support more reckless spending. It's got to stop." He apparently told friends that if it didn't stop, he would stop it. It is openly whispered in Texas among Mr. Garner's home advisers that he will lead the opposition in Congress to measures not acceptable to many Democrats, the Times reported. Among the measures not acceptable was Roosevelt's attempt to reorganize and expand the White House staff and the executive branch of government generally. This measure, on its face, as James McGregor Burns says, one of the least controversial Roosevelt had ever proposed, brought to a boil the long-simmering anti-Roosevelt bitterness in Congress, which, despite heroic efforts by Sam Rayburn and the prodigal use by Roosevelt of patronage to try to bring congressmen to heel, voted down the dictator bill. As the vote was announced, Burns recounts, wild cheering broke out among representatives in the chamber. Congress was in open revolt. At this time, Roosevelt took his first public cognizance of the rumors about the rift between him and Garner. He denied that it existed. When Garner was asked about it, he merely smiled, then tightened his lips. But then came the purge, a cross-country trip on which Roosevelt attempted to defeat in their district primaries selected representatives and senators who had opposed him. John Garner, to whom party unity was so vital, could hardly believe that a president was doing this to members of his own party. In fact, at the time of the court compromise, he had personally promised senators, his intimates believe on the basis of a commitment given to him by Roosevelt, that there would be no reprisals from the White House. Some of Roosevelt's targets were, moreover, among Garner's oldest friends and closest allies. He no longer bothered to keep his feelings secret. In Texas, where Roosevelt snubbed Garner's friend Senator Tom Connally by announcing from the back platform of his train the appointment to a federal judgeship of a Texan who was a Connally enemy, Garner stayed home in Uvalde, telling reporters he was busy fishing. The President of the United States had come to the Vice President's state, and the Vice President had refused to meet him. When Garner returned to Washington from Texas on December 18, 1938, Garner and Roosevelt met privately for the last time. "We didn't get anywhere," Roosevelt told Farley. "Jack is very much opposed to the spending program. He's against the tax program, and he's against the relief program. He seems to be pretty much against everything, and he hasn't got a single concrete idea to offer on any one of these programs. It's one thing to criticize, but something else again to offer solutions." At the next cabinet meeting, Garner's feelings spilled over. When the hated liberal Henry Wallace began discussing new plans to reduce the cotton surplus, the vice president, in Ickes's words, "opened up all along the line on cotton. The vice president said that people had moved into the South because they liked to be free, and the freedom that they wanted was the right to grow as much cotton as they wanted to grow. He believes that restricting crops is bad, both economically and politically. He reminded the president that he had discussed this subject with him at their recent conference." He opened up in his Capitol Hill stronghold, too. A week after the cabinet meeting, Time reported that congressional Democrats were determined to have economy in government at last, and that, if they need a leader, John Garner stood ready to lead. The nation was given, at last, a glimpse of the power he had long wielded, in what Time called an unusual spectacle, a scene that may, in fact, have been all but unprecedented in American politics. On the same day, two cabinet members, appointees of the president, had to call hat in hand on the vice president to plead for congressional approval of the president's policies. Wallace to try to persuade him on acreage restrictions, Harry Hopkins to obtain Senate confirmation as Secretary of Commerce. Roosevelt himself had to go to Garner hat in hand. When Hopkins came close to breaking under the vicious questioning by a Senate committee, Roosevelt asked his vice president, in Ickes's phrase, to call off the dogs for the sake of the party. Garner did. He refused, however, to give in on acreage, and also beat the president on the relief bill. In the cabinet now, the two men who sat at opposite ends of the table could barely contain their enmity for each other. Sometimes, when Roosevelt was talking, Garner would begin talking, not in a whisper at his end of the table. Sometimes, in what Ickes felt was a truculent, very unpleasant manner, he would interrupt the president, saying, "Well, didn't I tell you so? Or, you remember that I brought that up 2 or 3 years ago." Said Ickes, "How the president takes this from Garner or anyone else is more than I can understand. I suspect that there is growing up in the president's heart a hatred of Garner." Notified during a cabinet meeting of still another Senate defeat by Garner's allies, Roosevelt, staring down the table at Garner, said, "Well, that is that. Now we will go on to Chapter 2. After the meeting, talking with Ickes, he said, "Do you notice that I am whistling?" And he was, more or less, from between his teeth, Ickes says. Then he added, "I always whistle when I'm mad." By 1939, Ickes himself, seeing Garner's old red wizened face on the rostrum above the president when the president delivered his message to Congress, found him disgusting. Even the King and Queen of England were not exempt from his rudeness. At the White House dinner for their majesties, "He was as full of life as a kitten. He has no breeding or natural dignity, and I doubt if he exercised any more self-restraint than he would have shown at a church supper in Uvalde, Texas. He pawed the king with his hands. To Garner, the king was simply a visiting elk." Younger New Dealers, including, as one reporter wrote, those ambitious young intellectuals around Mr. Roosevelt and their journalistic friends, got blue in the face when you mentioned John Garner's name. Time reported in a March 20, 1939 cover story on Garner, titled Undeclared War, that John Garner has become to arch New Dealers a symbol of sabotage. They consider him a prairie politician whose archaic notions, plus popular veneration for long public service, accidentally make him the leader of reaction against 6 years of enlightened reform. The articles of the young New Dealers' journalistic friends reflected the intensity of their feelings about the old Texan. Wrote Hamilton Basso in the New Republic, "His heart, and most of his mental processes, belong to the America of 1875. As a person, he is not liked. Mr. Garner has taken his personal smallness, his lack of generosity, and forged it into a political principle. The metaphysicians may argue that this per se is not evil, but on a human plane it is certainly not good. He has no imagination, no convictions, and he substitutes political cynicism for social understanding." In his Newsweek column, Raymond Moley, himself long gone from the reservation, offered a different opinion. "A good many of the feature articles about Mr. Garner managed to suggest that he's a kind of glorified clown, spending his time thinking up what the next wisecrack should be, what kind of funny hat to wear the next time his picture is taken, and what he can eat and drink that will look well in the newsreels. The trouble with those who write such pieces, and there are a good many earning a living in Washington, is that they can never take a man for what he is. They've seen so many phonies in their day that they automatically conclude that nothing is what it seems to be. It is true that Mr. Garner is picturesque. I've never thought of calling him anything but Mr. Garner. Not many people call him Jack to his face. There is dignity about the man. He's picturesque only because his method of life, which is simple and natural, contrasts so weirdly with the sham living that goes on in Washington. He's a man who lives his life as he wants to live it." The New Dealers' feelings were reciprocated by the object of their scorn. He detested what even their journalist friends had to concede was their slightly ostentatious intellectualism, what he saw as a hypocrisy which made them talk of principles when, as he told a friend, "All they're interested in is staying in power." They were, in Garner's view, unscrupulous men who were persuading the president to desert his party, the party Garner loved. And now the feud was climaxing, for the presidential election of 1940 was drawing steadily closer. Historians may puzzle over when Franklin Roosevelt decided to defy the third-term tradition and run for the presidency again, but John Garner's intimates never had the slightest doubt as to what the decision would be. "Why, he is panting to run," one of them said as early as the autumn of 1938. and neither did Garner, although Roosevelt had assured him he would not run again. "He has too much power and is continually asking for more," he had told Timmons. That predilection could lead to only one decision. Later, he would tell Timmons, "He will never leave the White House except in death or defeat." Garner, Timmons wrote, abhorred even the idea of a third term for any president, good or bad. The basis for his abhorrence was simple. 4 decades in Washington had taught him what power did to men. "No man should exercise great powers too long," he said. On another occasion, he was to say, "We don't want any kings or emperors in this country. You have to curb the ambitions of every man, even the best of them, because they are human." Often now, there crept into his blunt conversation, when discussing Roosevelt, the word dictator. Whether or not he wanted the Democratic nomination for himself, whether, as his advisers were to maintain, he was standing for the nomination merely as an anti-third-term symbol, or whether, as the New Dealer said, the 70-year-old poker player, having long bided his time, had at last found himself holding a royal flush and could scarcely contain his greed at the pot within his grasp, he was determined that the nomination would not go to Franklin Roosevelt. And Roosevelt, whether or not he had decided to run again, was determined that his successor not be someone who might tear down what he had built. He was determined to deny the nomination to any of the Democratic conservatives who did not believe in the New Deal. In particular, he was determined that the nomination would not go to John Garner. 1939 was Garner's year. The war was open now. The Garner gang of conservative congressional barons, Time magazine said, had long been bound together by intangible ties of friendship for and trust in the old man. Since Speaker Uncle Joe Cannon, who finally met in Jack Garner his match at poker, no man has enjoyed such influence among members on both sides of the aisle in both houses as this stubby, stubborn, pink-and-white Billiken with the beak of an owl, eyebrows like Cupid's wings, tongue of a cowhand. And he was using that influence to the full. During the first months of 1939, Congress defeated several Roosevelt proposals. Then the president proposed a new public works program for self-liquidating projects, which would include the creation of a revolving fund fed from the earnings of these projects, which could be used to finance new projects when there is need of extra stimulus of employment. Garner felt that this proposal would free the executive branch from the need of congressional approval for these projects. "This bill, in some particulars, is the worst that has come up here," he said. "It gives the president discretion to spend billions where he wants to, how he wants to, and when he wants. It is another step away from constitutional government and toward personal government." The House, by a substantial majority, refused even to take it up for debate. Previously, the president had relied on Garner to kill or hamstring potentially damaging congressional investigations. Now, a young Texas congressman, Martin Dies, Jr., 30 years before Garner had served in the House with Martin Dies, Sr., was given a substantial appropriation for his House on American Activities Committee, which, as William Lichtenberg puts it, served the purposes of those who claimed that the New Deal was a red stratagem. And over furious administration opposition, Congress passed, and Roosevelt was forced to sign, the Hatch Act, which would in the event prove ineffective, because Garner believed the administration did not enforce it, but which at the time of its passage was believed to be a deterrent to political activity by federal employees. The reason for its passage was common knowledge in Washington. At the 1936 Democratic Convention, a majority of the delegates had been made up of postmasters, United States Marshals, IRS employees, and other federal office holders who might be disposed to favor an incumbent president. Garner and his conservative allies wanted to make sure that the incumbent president would have no such advantage at the 1940 convention. A sullen world was, in Burns's phrase, girdling for war. A sullen Congress refused to change the Neutrality Act to give the president more room to maneuver on behalf of the embattled democracies. Summoning Senate leaders to the White House, Roosevelt pleaded with them. Then Garner asked them if there were enough votes to change the act, and summed up, Well, Captain, we may as well face the facts. You haven't got the votes, and that's all there is to it. He had turned the vice presidency, Time said, from a sarcophagus into a throne. And if 1939 was Garner's year on Capitol Hill, it was his year in the polls, too. In March, the Gallup poll asked the question, if Roosevelt is not a candidate, whom would you like to see elected? Jim Farley received 8%, Cordell Hull 10%, John Garner 45%. And Roosevelt could hardly have been sanguine about the results if his name had been included in the poll. 53% of all Democrats were opposed to a third term. As the new republic had to report with chagrin, political prognosticators generally felt that a candidate with so commanding a lead could not be overtaken. Pollster Emil Hurria said that Mr. Garner is so far ahead of all other candidates that he cannot be stopped. If he was to be stopped, certainly only one man could do it, just as Garner himself was the only man who could stop Roosevelt if Roosevelt chose to run. As the Congressional Digest put it, it is a case of Franklin D. Roosevelt, epitome of the New Deal, against John Nance Garner, to whom much of the New Deal is anathema. Discussing possible candidates with Jim Farley at Hyde Park, Roosevelt said, "To begin with, there's Garner. He's just impossible." Although other names would continually be floated, the contest had, in 1939, narrowed down to two men, each of whom not only hated the other personally, but hated also much of what the other stood for. Roosevelt decided to attack Garner in his own state. There was reason to think this bold tactic might have success. While the reactionary interests which ran Texas were solidly against the president, the state's people had, at least in the past, been overwhelmingly behind him. They had given him a 7-1 margin over Landon in 1936. Even if he could not defeat Garner in the state's 1940 Democratic primary, might he not at least poll a respectable number of votes against him, enough to embarrass him? And being forced to fight in his own stronghold might keep Garner on the defensive. If he was to fight Garner in Texas, however, Roosevelt needed a man in Texas, someone to direct his strategy in the state, preferably someone prominent enough throughout the state to serve as a rallying point for New Deal enthusiasm. The list of potential candidates, however, was very short. A senator would have been ideal, but one, Tom Connally, had earned the president's bitter enmity by opposing the court-packing proposal. And while the other, mild-mannered Morris Shepherd, was a loyal New Dealer, he put personal loyalties above political, and his personal loyalty belonged to the man who had come to Congress at virtually the same time as he, 36 years before. Among the state's congressmen, Morey Maverick would, a year earlier, have been a logical choice, because his willingness to speak out for liberal causes had not only endeared him to Roosevelt, but had made him a statewide name. Another congressman, W.D. McFarlane of Graham, Sam Johnson's one-time populist ally in the state legislature, was an eager volunteer for the job. On the Texas leg of Roosevelt's 1938 cross-country purge trip, the trip on which Garner had refused to meet him, the president had praised Maverick and McFarlane. But despite the praise, by 1939, both Maverick and McFarlane were no longer in Congress, having lost their congressional seats to conservative opponents. Maverick's election as mayor of San Antonio in 1939 was blighted by his indictment later that year on the charge of using union contributions to pay supporters' poll taxes. Although he would later be acquitted, he was hardly in a position to serve as a president's standard-bearer. Garner had had his San Antonio friends support Maverick in 1936. In 1938, the vice president had quietly passed the word that he wanted Maverick crushed. And crushed he was by Paul Kilday, who stated that his goal was the elimination from Congress of one overwhelmingly shown to be the friend and ally of communism. There was another obvious choice, Sam Rayburn. But this was the Sam Rayburn of whom it was said, if he was your friend, he was your friend forever. He would be with you always. The tougher the going, the more certain you could be that when you looked around, Sam Rayburn would be standing there with you. In a contest between Roosevelt and Garner, Rayburn's preference was not for Garner, but for the man whose picture stood on his desk at home in Bonham. Garner was his friend, but Roosevelt was his hero. Moreover, the philosophy of the New Deal was his philosophy. Garner's was not. "There is much more of contrast than of similarity between the two Texans," wrote Raymond Moley, who knew them both well. The contrast was deeper than the differences in their bank balances, or the fact that Rayburn would not accept a free pass from the railroads, while Garner rode back and forth to Texas in the luxuriously furnished private car of the president of the Missouri-Kansas Pacific line. As Moley explained, "Garner is a big businessman, with few prejudices against financial power and limited sympathy for the underprivileged. Rayburn is more likely to suffer for those who fail." Garner's opposition to the New Deal had, Moley says, opened a fissure between him and Rayburn. Furthermore, Rayburn had no doubt that Roosevelt would eventually decide to run again. And he had no doubt that if Roosevelt ran, he would crush any other candidate. Garner's campaign for the nomination would not only be one in which Rayburn did not believe, it was, Rayburn knew, bound to be a losing fight. But while Roosevelt was his hero, Garner was his friend, had been his friend for a quarter of a century. More, Garner had been his patron. During Rayburn's difficult early years in Congress, it was Garner who had given him the helping hand that enabled him to start climbing the House ladder. In 1937, when Rayburn had been in danger of losing his fight to be majority leader, and next in line for his yearned-for speakership, Garner had rushed back from Texas to throw his weight on the scales and tip them in Rayburn's favor. Rayburn's reply, when a reporter had asked about the propriety of the vice president's intervention in a congressional matter, was instructive. "In the first place," he said, "Jack Garner is my friend." When, in 1939, Garner asked him to manage his campaign for the 1940 Democratic presidential nomination, he agreed. And once he had enlisted in Garner's cause, it didn't matter how tough the going was. Attempting to pry Rayburn away from his fellow Texan, White House sources raised the possibility that, despite Rayburn's leadership of New Deal causes, he might not be the president's choice to replace Speaker Bankhead, whose heart disease was rapidly worsening. This threat to Rayburn's long-held dream was a grave one. Roosevelt's potential in Capitol Hill succession battles had been demonstrated by his success in winning the Senate majority leadership for Alvin Barkley. But Woodrow Wilson could have told Roosevelt what Rayburn's response to a presidential threat would be. Previously, Rayburn had been somewhat circumspect in his remarks on the presidential race. After the first White House leaks appeared, he issued a more pointed statement. "I am for that outstanding Texan and liberal Democrat, John N. Garner, for the presidential nomination in 1940, believing that if elected he will make the country a great president." Roosevelt's reaction to Rayburn's defiance was revealed a month later. Rayburn's district held a celebration in his honor each August. "In previous years," Stephen Early wrote in a memo to the president, "you have sent messages to Sam Rayburn on the occasion of the celebration. Ordinarily, I would take care of this without troubling you, but in light of Rayburn's recent declarations, I think it is best to leave the decision to you." Roosevelt's decision was not to send a message. During succeeding months, as long as Garner was in the presidential race, in fact, Roosevelt would not even autograph a picture for Rayburn. When, for example, Rayburn's secretary, Alla Clary, sent a photograph taken by one of Rayburn's friends to the White House for a routine presidential autograph, Missy LaHand returned it unsigned. Lyndon Johnson's application for the post of leader of the Roosevelt forces in Texas was at first not considered seriously. A junior congressman was hardly the ideal leader of the presidential campaign in a pivotal state. Nor did Johnson enjoy White House entree at this time, a fact which had been forcibly brought home to him during the president's purge trip of July 1938. He was not on the initial list of Texas congressmen invited aboard the president's train. Only a last-minute invitation wangled for him en route by the friendly McIntyre got him aboard. Once aboard, his name was added to the list of congressmen on whom Roosevelt bestowed public praise, but not to the list of those allowed a private few minutes with FDR, an omission which must have provided a bitter contrast to the hours of intimate conversation with the president he had enjoyed on that other train trip through Texas just a year before. Johnson was unopposed in the 1938 primary, but other Texas legislators running unopposed were among the invitees. The spring of 1939, when the initial jockeying over the Garner nomination was taking place, was the time when Johnson could not elicit a presidential response even to a letter. But as spring turned to summer, Johnson found a role he could play. Because of the leverage its committee chairman wielded with the congressmen from other states, the Texas congressional delegation was the power base for Garner's presidential bid. The canniness of the delegation's veteran members, augmented, of course, by the political wisdom and cash of its associate member, Roy Miller, and the nationwide political contacts built up during decades of dealing on Capitol Hill, made the delegation, in a sense, the general staff of the Garner campaign as well. At its weekly luncheon meetings, and whenever, in fact, Texas congressmen got together, the vice president's strategy was discussed and planned. The White House needed to know what was going on in those meetings. It needed a spy in the Texas ranks. Lyndon Johnson volunteered for this mission. No formal enlistment was necessary. He simply began to relay information to members of the White House staff, primarily to Corcoran and occasionally to Roe, with his customary assiduity. "He was working at it, I'll tell you that," Roe says. "Johnson was playing a dangerous game," Roe says, "and sooner or later they would find out, but he could see over the horizon, and he could see that Garner's day was over, and he was playing with our crowd instead of the Garner crowd." Obtaining information on the discussions in the Texas delegation had been very hard, Roe says, but it suddenly became much easier. If we wanted to know something, call Lyndon Johnson. In July, he took on a new role. There was one asset that only he among the Texas congressmen possessed: Charles Marsh's friendship. Texas newspapers were overwhelmingly anti-Roosevelt, but Marsh's six Texas newspapers, including the influential paper in the state capitol, were for him. The publisher of six pro-Roosevelt Texas dailies had very little difficulty getting in to see the president, and when Marsh requested an appointment, he asked if he could bring Johnson along. On July 14, 1939, Pa Watson sent an aide a note. "Put Mr. Charles Marsh down for an appointment with the president on Wednesday. Mr. Marsh is the owner of a large string of papers supporting the president in Texas." And on the note, someone, either Watson or the aide, added in handwriting, "And Representative Lyndon Johnson." At this meeting, Johnson impressed the president with his enthusiasm for the third term and with his political acumen. Something else was at work as well. Marsh and Roosevelt had been acquainted since the president's days as governor of New York. They had not gotten along well, at least in part because of Marsh's imperious personality, which allowed him to show deference not even to a governor. At the White House meeting, strain was again evident. But Marsh, the enthusiastic New Dealer, wanted to support Roosevelt, and Roosevelt wanted his support. And a buffer to make the relationship smoother was available, and Lyndon Johnson thus became the link to the most influential pro-Roosevelt organ in Texas. Then, 2 weeks later, came an opportunity for Johnson to dramatize, vividly, his loyalty to the president. During a bitter hearing on proposed amendments that would weaken wages and hours legislation, John L. Lewis exploded to the House Labor Committee, "The genesis of this campaign against labor is not hard to find. It emanates from a labor-baiting, poker-playing, whiskey-drinking, evil old man whose name is Garner." As committee members gasped, the lion-maned CIO leader, pounding the table until the ashtrays jumped, went on, "Some gentlemen may rise in horror and say, 'Why, Mr. Lewis has made a personal attack on Mr. Garner.' Yes, I make a personal attack on Mr. Garner for what he is doing, because Garner's knife is searching for the quivering, pulsating heart of labor." With reporters racing through Capitol corridors, searching for comment, Sam Rayburn summoned the Texas delegation to his office to issue a formal resolution denying the accuracy of Lewis's description of the vice president. But Roosevelt and his advisers did not want that description denied. As Kenneth G. Crawford noted in The Nation, "If they know the church-going public, its reaction will be, 'Where there's so much smoke, there must be some fire water.'" Roosevelt himself was shortly to give emphasis to Garner's drinking with his remark at a cabinet meeting. "I see that the Vice President has thrown his bottle, I mean his hat, into the ring." Telephone calls were hastily placed to the office of their secret ally within the Texas delegation, Lyndon Johnson. Corcoran was later to say, "Everybody called him. I called him. Ickes called him. There wasn't any doubt about what the old man wanted." By the time Johnson arrived in Rayburn's office, a resolution had already been prepared stating, among other points, that Garner was neither a heavy drinker nor unfriendly to labor. Johnson refused to sign it. There ensued what the Washington Post later called considerable discussion. Rayburn finally suggested that he take Johnson into his office and talk to him, but Johnson apparently stood his ground. The resolution that was finally read to a cheering house by Representative Luther A. Johnson of Corsicana, who said that it had been endorsed by the entire Texas delegation, did not contain a specific repudiation of the allegations about labor and whiskey. It said, "We who know him, Garner, best, cannot refrain from expressing our deep resentment and indignation at this unwarranted and unjustified attack on his private and public life. The Texas delegation has complete confidence in his honesty, integrity, and ability." Johnson made the most of his role in this episode. He described it to Roosevelt personally, who chuckled as he related it to Harold Ickes. Ickes was later to recount in his secret diary what Roosevelt said. Some grandiloquent resolutions had been drafted in advance, and every member of the delegation was asked to sign on the dotted line. Among other things, these resolutions declared that Garner was not a whiskey drinker and that he was not unfriendly to labor. The only voice raised in opposition was that of Congressman Lyndon B. Johnson of Austin. Johnson said that he could not subscribe to any such language and that the delegation would look foolish if such a statement were issued because everyone knew that Garner was a heavy drinker and that he was bitterly opposed to labor. The argument went on for some 2 hours, with Johnson maintaining his ground. Then Sam Rayburn suggested that he take Johnson into his office and talk to him. Of course, everyone thought that Rayburn would administer a spanking. However, Johnson still continued to hold his ground, and the crestfallen Rayburn led him back to the caucus, where he said that he hadn't been able to do anything with him. It was agreed that unless every member signed the resolutions, there was no point in issuing them. So the task was given to Johnson to draft such resolutions as he would be willing to sign. As Johnson recounted the episode to other New Dealers high and low, his extraordinary ability as a storyteller was never in better evidence. "Congressman Lyndon B. Johnson was in to see me," Ickes wrote in his diary. "He told me the very vivid story of the meeting of the Texas delegation. The pressure on Johnson was terrific. Sam Rayburn lost his temper. At one point he said to Johnson, 'Lyndon, I am looking you right in the eye,' and Johnson replied, 'And I am looking you right back in the eye.' Johnson says that he kept his temper and that, after it was all over, Rayburn apologized to him. However, Johnson refused to move." Johnson's depiction of his role in the delegation may have been somewhat exaggerated. On one point, Roosevelt had definitely received a false impression. Johnson was not given the task of drafting the final resolution. It was drawn up by Luther Johnson and two other senior members of the delegation, Milton H. West and Charles L. South. And in any case, the resolution, which Johnson did, after all, sign along with the other members, is certainly not a weak statement. His confrontation with Rayburn was apparently not as dramatic in fact as in the telling. Other members of the delegation and Texans familiar with its actions would later not recall any confrontation. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.